Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Emma Burgess from Stoke Lodge talks about the standoff of Stoke Lodge between Cottam School and the local residents. Cottam School putting up a fence all around what used to be open land. Also, Alex Craner. Well, he lives in France, but he's actually Croatian. He's written a book called Grand Deception, The Truth About Bill Browder and the Magnitsky Act. Now, this Magnitsky Act is going through the European Parliament and should be law in the EU very soon. It echoes a similar act in the United States, which is being used to shut down criticism of Russia. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
My name's Emma Burgess and I'm one of 1,200 members of a group called We Love Stoke Lodge. Stoke Lodge is a 28-acre site in the northwest of Bristol in Stoke Bishop. It is a Grade 2 listed estate. It has an adult education centre within the old listed house and 22 acres of playing fields and arboretums around it. It's an absolutely beautiful place, rolling, stunning place. Ancient trees, some of national significant importance. It really is quite beautiful. There's some decent views. Unfortunately, a huge amount of the green space in that area is now being sold off for housing development. So it's the last green space in Stoke Bishop, Seamills, Westbury-on-Trim area. And yes, it's very important to many people. It's the epicentre of our community. So Cottam School were leased Stoke Lodge at a peppercorn rent back in 2011. They'd been using the site for a number of years, but due to academisation, they needed a formal lease with Bristol City Council. So a lease was drawn up in which it was made very clear that their use of the land was subject to all existing rights and use by the community. And things were okay for a while, happily coexisting alongside Cottam School, using it as playing fields for just a few hours a week when they needed to use playing fields off-site. Cottam School's about 3 miles away from Stoke Lodge. But then they decided that they wanted to develop the site. So they had a consultant come in and have a look, and they looked at redeveloping a pavilion, a sports pavilion on site, which is a little bit dilapidated, and some options in terms of securing the site. And they came up with the idea of fencing Stoke Lodge. And the community weren't very happy about this being fenced out of what Bristol City Council says is an important open space and that people have been using for 70 years.
Well, most of our parks are fenced, aren't they? I mean, you know, you can't just get into them in the middle of the night, for example.
If you think about the Downs, if you think about 14, 15 other schools that we've found across Bristol, they use unfenced, open access playing fields all across Bristol and all across the UK. Schools are happily using unfenced open access playing fields. This isn't school premises, it's 3 miles away. Department for Education has said it's not school premises.
I mean, how well used is the land, you know, despite if you could ignore the fences, and how well was it used? And when did the fences first go up?
So the fences started going up a couple of weeks ago. This has been going on now for about 8-9 years. And the council have taken some quite interesting decisions recently. So for the last 20 years, this estate has been considered to be listed as far as planning permission is concerned. So if you wanted to do anything within the estate, you had to apply for planning permission. It's my belief that Cottam School felt that they wouldn't get a fence through planning permission due to some major considerations with the trees, the fact that it is open important space, the fact that the community are using it so extensively, a number of different reasons. So they chose to go to a barrister and get a legal opinion. to say that actually this Grade 2 listed estate, the fields themselves weren't listed or aren't forming curtilage with part of the listed building. Bristol City Council have gone to the same barrister's chamber to get their own opinion and said, yes, actually, we agree with you. It isn't listed. We know we've said it's listed for the last 20 years, but we now agree with you, using the same barrister's chambers, that it's not. Therefore, they have given them permission to build a 1.5 kilometre, 2 metre high metal fence around 22 acres of this land.
How has that affected what local people can do?
They started...
So the idea, of course, is this fence is there for the school to keep possible paedophiles or, this kind of thing out. But it's actually keeping local people out as well.
It is indeed, yeah. I mean, if I take the story back, so back in 2014, they got this consultant's report that I was talking to you about. And basically, they wanted either a fence. And in the consultant's report, it said that if you are looking for grant funding from what is now the Education Skills Funding Agency, within your application, it will help you if you cite safeguarding issues. 3 days later, the school's facilities manager turned up at Stoke Lodge that they'd been happily using for 10 or so years and put an immediate stop order on them using the site and said there was a clear and present danger from strange danger, in effect, and a clear and present danger of attack from dogs. He rated that as a high risk and then said that they weren't able to use the fields, and then they applied for grant funding to get the fence
in. I mean, it does sound to me a bit like a land grab. I mean, what are the local people doing about it?
So there have been a number of campaigns over the years. So there's an organisation called Save Stoke Lodge Parkland who've been working very proactively over the last 7 or 8 years. I only came into this last May. There was an interesting decision that was made by Bristol City Council about not granting town or village green status to the land. And there was a meeting. I popped along to this meeting and recognised that there was a slightly different demographic. A lot of people within the community weren't necessarily being represented because they didn't necessarily know about this issue. I'd been using the land quite happily for 14 years and I wasn't aware that this was going on, that there were legal battles and all of this legacy. So I stood up at this meeting and said, I think it would be really good to get some social media involved. So I set up a Facebook group called We Love Stoke Lodge. We now have 1,200 members. We're being supported by a large number of councillors from across Bristol. We're being supported by our MP, Darren Jones.
Are you being supported by Marvin Rees, the mayor?
Actually, Marvin has tried recently.
But he's in charge.
Yes. So on Marvin's Facebook Live a couple of weeks ago, he reached out to the school and said that he would mediate a meeting between the school and ourselves. Unfortunately, the schools refused that and said they will only talk to certain community groups once the fence has been built.
But this is council land. Surely they can still make decisions, or they leased it and they're now saying Cotton School that they can do what they want.
We believe that Bristol City Council have the right to make decisions around this. We believe they've made a legally wrong decision about permitted development, and we are challenging them through the courts. In the lease, it is very clear that if you want to build a structure, you have to have the landlord's consent. Look up in the Oxford English Dictionary what a fence is. It says it's a structure. Bristol City Council are saying no, it's not a structure, and therefore they don't need to give their consent.
What's Marvin saying?
Marvin is saying, I will mediate a meeting between the school and the community, but he's basically saying that it is down to the Developmental Control Committee within Bristol City Council. And it's down to his planning officers.
But I mean, you're not paying for the use of the land. Neither is the school.
Neither is the school.
No?
No, it's a peppercorn rent.
So I was going to say money talks, but it doesn't seem to count in this
No, I mean, when I first came into this, I couldn't understand how a reputable school in Bristol was battling with a whole community of thousands of people. It just seems strange that, they were at loggerheads. And why couldn't we sit down and have an adult discussion about some compromises and ways of working? So Darren Jones supported us.
He's the local MP.
He is, yes. And he went to Ofsted, who said, we don't require a fence at Stoke Lodge. He went to the Department of Education, so he did lots of research first.
So why do Cotton say they have to have one?
Because they say there is a clear and present danger
of to dogs their attacking their
exactly.
pupils.
So we said to them, okay, if you've
are you a dog walker?
I own a dog, yes. I don't think he's he is a clear and present danger. sorry, I've lost my trail of thought.
Yeah, so Marvin sort of helping or not helping.
No, Darren.
Yeah. Sorry,
so,
Darren, yes.
Yeah, so basically they say there's a clear and present danger. They did this risk assessment, said it was high risk. Bristol City Council's health and safety officer has looked at this risk assessment and said, actually, that risk is overrated. Why don't you look to the best practice of other schools and what they're doing? Actually, it should be a medium risk. And a medium risk means you should implement measures that aren't too troublesome or costly. So far, the school has spent nearly £150,000 on legal and consultancy fees battling this. Today, they are building a fence which is costing £160,000 and they can't use the site because they don't have planning permission for any facilities on site. It's been refused by the council twice. They don't have any grant funding to develop the site into playing fields. So they're currently building a fence at the tune of £160,000, around 22 acres, to fence the community out. It is highly likely they won't be able to use this site for the foreseeable future.
I mean, have you spoken one-to-one with any of the managers or governors of Cotton School?
We've very much tried. So going back to Darren Jones's intervention, he went off and did a load of research and then he finally called us together in a meeting in City Hall. So myself and a whole load of people in the community did lots of research about some, you know, compromise agreements. So, yeah, we don't like the fence, but could we look at different types of fencing? So estate fencing, could we look at different ways of working? And we came up with a huge list of proposals to take to this meeting. So we sit in the meeting with Cotton School, the lead governor that's leading this project for them, and a number of other stakeholders, and Darren and local councillors, and a representative of Thangham Debonair, it's her ward, Cotton, came along to the meeting as well. And so we introduced ourselves and we said, raft of proposals, really, you know, delighted to be able to talk to you about different ideas and solutions that we will fund, that we can access grant funding for. And the school governor basically said, if you don't like the current fence, which is 1.5 kilometres, 2 metre high, black mesh, then our compromise is that we will build a bigger fence and we will never let you in. So the fence that kind of put pay to the meeting.
Well,
really.
Apparently the fence is also quite dangerous. It's sharp.
It is indeed. And
so can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it might be worthwhile just going through the second meeting that we had with Cotton School first, just to get some sort of chronology around it. So Darren Jones said to the school, why don't you go away and have a think about these ideas over the summer? We gave them a list of 12 schools in Bristol to go off and talk to about best practice, schools that don't fence playing fields and happily use them so they could get some ideas about how they control risks. So we went then back in September to have another meeting with the school to see how they'd fared over the summer. And they basically said that unless you shut down your Facebook campaign, stop asking for freedom of information requests and stop campaigning, we are not prepared to speak to you again. And that is how things have been since. So Darren hasn't been able to get any further meetings set up with them, despite Marvin saying on his Facebook Live, I will mediate a meeting. The school has refused to do so.
I'm thinking about those who are in charge of the education of, I don't know how many children go to the Cotton.
It's a huge, reputable and important school.
Do you know how many pupils they have?
I think it's 1,400.
It's a little bit concerning that the people who are charged with that job of educating those young people have this kind of what sounds like a bunker mentality.
I think it's a very closed ship. I think, you know, they don't have a full head set of governors at the moment. They've got a large number of vacancies. The lead governor who's been running on this for the last 8 years, it feels to me that it's her project and her baby.
And so she doesn't want to climb down. But I mean, well, she will say, of course. I mean, she's not with us today, but if she were, I'm sure she'd say, I'm just trying to protect my children.
Yes, yeah. And we've come up with a range of ideas that are lower cost and we believe more effective for safeguarding the children that need to use Stoke Lodge. You know, we are parents, we are a community. 3,500 people have signed a petition in the local area to ask the council to go through the proper democratic process when it comes to Stoke Lodge. We are all parents, and we want somewhere safe for our children to be as well. We know there's common ground there. We do not believe that this fence actually addresses their safeguarding risks. We think it presents more risks, and that's been found out this week.
So, yes, tell us about that.
Yeah, so we saw a note in the governor's meeting notes on the 23rd of May for Cottam School, and it was very brief. It just said that the health and safety executive report had been discussed. So we wondered what that was, and we put in a freedom of information request, and that came through last week. And basically what we asked the health and safety executive for was any incidents that had happened on any playing fields in Bristol, because it was also useful then to see how, you know, if there were other incidents we needed to maybe think about in our ideas and solutions for Stoke Lodge. There are very, very few incidents on playing fields, and most of them where, you know, the terrain's quite rough or dodgy and people had hurt their ankles. But the most serious incident was actually a Cottam School pupil who was playing just 500 yards away from Stoke Lodge in a facility that the school rent from the university. It's called Coomdingle Sports Complex. And the teacher had 30 pupils to look after inside quite a small pitched area with a fence around it. The pupil was asked to go and retrieve a ball that had gone out of this pitched area. So they picked up the ball, threw it back in, and rather than walking around and coming through the gate, they decided to climb over the fence. Unfortunately, the teacher hadn't done a jewellery check on the pupils. So when this pupil had a ring on their finger, so when they sat on the top of the fence, they then jumped down, and unfortunately that severed the child's finger off. So awful tragic accident. But the concern we have is that the school doesn't appear to be learning from this. So the health and safety contravention letter that was and report that was sent through to the school that was discussed on the 23rd of May by the governors said that they needed to reconsider their staffing ratios, and they needed to think about putting hatches into fencing so that, you know, pupils could get in and out and retrieve balls. 2 days later, Cottam School published plans to put the 1.5-kilometre fence in around Stoke Lodge with the same staffing ratios. Today, on site, they're building it. They've built 385 metres so far. There are no hatches in it. The school have said today that they only need to put a hatch in if the fence is 3 metres tall, not 2 metres tall. In my mind, more children will climb over a 2 metre fence. You know, this incident, this horrible incident happened in a small enclosed pitch. These pupils are going to have one teacher to 30 pupils in a 22-acre site. A lot of it you can't actually see because it bends around the house. So how the teacher is going to be able to safeguard those children?
How likely is it, do you think, that a ball might be kicked over that fence?
It's quite scary, actually, because if you look at the pitch layout that the school have published, basically you've got pitches running into great big oak trees. So the corner of a football pitch would be a 200-year-old massive great big oak tree. So we're not quite sure what's going to happen to that tree. But also at one end, right next to a main road roundabout, they've got the rugby posts. So basically you kick the rugby ball onto a main road. So I don't think the pitch layout has been considered very well either. But as to whether they'll actually ever be able to get back to playing sports at Stoke Lodge is the big question, because they don't have any money from a grant funding perspective to put pitches back in. If you come and visit Stoke Lodge, it undulates. We had a health and safety expert come out and help us form the proposals to take to the school, and they said actually the biggest risk here is the ground. You know, there's a 10-metre drop in the ground across the site. They don't have any money to do any of that pitch development, so it's going to have to come out of their reserves. They have nowhere for the children to change or to go to the toilet, which is a DFES requirement. They have to have changing facilities and toilet facilities.
I mean, how much has all this got to do, do you think, with the fact that the school is an academy, whereas in the past, of course, these kind of schools would have been run by a local authority?
I think it's got an awful lot to do with that. And, you know, we have been asking some questions around ESFA, around the best use of
around
our education.
Who?
So ESFA, they are the people that control school budgets, be it academy or not. So the Education Skills Funding Agency. So they dole out the cash from the Department for Education to academies. And we have been working with them, as has our MP and councillors, asking them questions around how is £700,000 worth of their grant funding being best used fencing Stoke Lodge? And we're yet to get some responses to those questions. There's no value for money here. It doesn't stack up commercially. So the school are currently renting provision 500 yards away, Coombe Dingle Sports Centre, where this horrific accident happened. It costs them £30,000 a year for that provision. They're saying in their grant statement that the reason we need to spend £700,000 developing Stoke Lodge is because we have to pay £30,000 a year to use somewhere else. We went to the university and said, actually, can you just tell us what they've spent over the last 10 or so years? And actually, the school was still spending £30,000 a year, even when they had full access to Stoke Lodge for many years. So that the whole value for money statement they put into ESFA to get £700,000 worth of the education budget investment, that whole value for money statement is purely based on the fact that they had to rent somewhere else for £30,000. And that's misinformation. It's not true.
So are you going to be closing your Facebook account? Are you going to be stopping freedom of information requests, Emma?
Ever since the school asked us back in September, they were very upset about the freedom of information requests that we put in. We haven't submitted any more through the open what do you know system. We have emailed the school and said, you asked us to do this via email privately. Please, can we have a copy of something once since they mentioned it? We haven't yet had a response to that.
What about the Facebook? Are you going to close your Facebook?
Absolutely not. I was stood on Stoke Lodge on Sunday. We organised a fun run because so many people have been so upset watching this fence go up, and we needed to bring our community together. And it was amazing. We had 2 days' notice, 800 people turned up. And there were people from four generations there, stood looking at a fence, crying. This place is so important to so many people. We're not going to give up this fight. But what we are continuing to do is to put an olive branch out to the school to say, please sit down and talk to us about this. Hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of the education budget is being wasted on this. I've put a town or village green application in that has been validated. That town or village green application has actually already been tested through inspectors and through a High Court ruling, and those tests have already been met. It was kicked out last time because of an administration procedural error by Bristol City Council. So I'm feeling very, very confident that that town or village green application is going to be successful. And that means that the school will have to take the fence down, which is £160,000 worth of wasted money plus removal costs. So I think it's really important that we sit and work with the school. You know, we want Cotton pupils to be back at Stoke Lodge playing sports. It worked really well for many, many years. We coexisted happily. We believe that as a community, supporting the school actually makes them safer. Stoke Bishop has got one of the lowest crime areas in Bristol, and getting that community support, a huge community charter, grant funding, we can do all sorts of things to make this an amazing space, both for Cotton pupils, other schools in the local area who don't have much outdoor PE facilities, and our community. And we think it could be a blueprint for something really, really special. But at the moment, Cotton School want to do that through the courts rather than sitting down and talking to us, which just seems crazy.
That was Emma Burgess, and her Facebook group is called We Love Stoke Lodge.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Alex Kraner. I'm a Croatian national based out of Monaco. I work as a hedge fund manager. I trade commodities for a living. And the way I stumbled upon the whole Bill Browder hoax is because at one point during my life, I was invited to one of Bill Browder's presentations. And this was in 2005. While he was still a great, outspoken fan of Vladimir Putin. And so under the auspices of the International University of Monaco, they organized the presentation here, and I was invited. And so for people who don't know who Bill Browder is, he used to be the hedge fund manager who ran the largest foreign-owned Russian investment fund out of Moscow. The fund's name was Hermitage Capital Management. And it was active in the 1990s, I think through 2006, more or less. And so the reason why Bill Browder has risen to notoriety lately is because he is the main mover behind the 2012 Magnitsky Act. So he has done the bulk of the footwork to lobby through the Magnitsky Act in the United States.
And maybe we better start by explaining, what is Magnitsky or who is Magnitsky?
Sure, yeah. So the Magnitsky Act is considered to be the opening salvo of the current Cold War between Russia and the United States and other Western nations. And the reason it's called Magnitsky is because Sergei Magnitsky was Bill Browder's accountant for his Russia Hermitage Fund. And in reality, Sergei Magnitsky was instrumental for Bill Browder to minimize his tax bill in Russia, whereas Bill Browder himself represents Sergei Magnitsky as his lawyer. Now, the thing about Sergei Magnitsky is that he died in 2009 in a Russian prison. And this was a very unfortunate tragedy. But once Sergei Magnitsky died, Bill Browder has built up essentially a myth about Sergei Magnitsky, this larger-than-life, brave, incorruptible fighter for justice and truth and against corruption. And he was killed by the Russian state, who detained him in order to get at Bill Browder himself. Sergei Magnitsky was an accountant. And he worked for the company named Firestone Duncan. This was a legal office ran in Moscow by one American lawyer named Jamie Firestone. And Bill Browder's company, Hermitage Capital, was a client of Firestone Duncan, the legal office in Moscow. Sergei Magnitsky worked for Firestone Duncan. And his mandate was to provide a tax minimizing schemes for Bill Browder's companies and his investors and for himself. And so basically the scheme that Sergei Magnitsky put together would have been technically legal. Okay, so this is how it worked. Russia gave certain tax breaks for investors to invest in certain regions of Russia that were underdeveloped. One of them was called Kalmykia. And so if you invested in Kalmykia, if you set up your business there and you employed local labor, particularly if you employed local disabled people and veterans of war, your tax bill would be 5% rather than 35%. So it was technically legal for investors to set up shell companies in Kalmykia, so long as there was a local representation, actual offices, and so long as they actually employed physical people to work real jobs at these offices. So many people did this, and it was technically legal, and it didn't create very many problems. But in Bill Browder's case, the problem is that he never hired the people. They put them down as employees on paper, but they never hired them. These people didn't actually work for Bill Browder's companies in Kalmykia, right? And so,
were they working for subcontractors or something?
No, they were just supposedly hired on paper. They didn't work for him at all. They were just like individuals in Russia off of the list of these veterans and disabled people, whom they put down as their employees, but they didn't really work for them. So when, and I think this was 2002 or 2003, when it came time to file the taxes, and Hermitage Capital filed to pay 5% tax bill, the tax authorities reviewed their case and said, like, no, you're actually not employing these people. They're supposed to work for you. They're supposed to come to your office and do an actual job and get training and so forth. But you're not doing any of that. So your tax bill is 35%. And at that point, rather than the thing to understand about this, it's a little bit legalistic, but Bill Browder was officially the CEO of these companies. One of them was called Dalnaya Step. One of them was called Saturn, or Saturn Invest, or something like this. And Bill Browder was the CEO of these companies, and he was personally liable for filing taxes correctly. Now, when the tax authorities said, no, you owe 35%, not 5%, rather than paying the back taxes, Bill Browder bankrupted the company to say, like, well, you know, too bad, these companies are gone, you know, the money's gone, we can't pay taxes. And so from this point on, it's in 2003, the Russian authorities initiated an investigation for tax fraud.
Well, that's quite reasonable, because obviously he's paying tax on profits. So yes. If he didn't make any profits, then he can't. Then it's possible he might go bankrupt, but then he shouldn't be paying any tax anyway if he's made money. And if he's made money, why is he going bankrupt? So I can imagine the Russian authorities really scratching their heads at that point.
Yes, yes. So the investigation had its merits. It wasn't politically motivated, because, you know, Bill Browder now wants to represent it as a politically motivated persecution. But that's not true, because at the time, Bill Browder built a reputation as the most outspoken supporter of Vladimir Putin. Okay, so there was no question about him being persecuted because he supported opposition or something like this. He was an outspoken Vladimir Putin supporter, and this was well understood. So it was purely a legal process based on the fact that not only did he fail to pay taxes correctly, but once he got the bill to pay the full amount of taxes he was owing, he bankrupted the entities that were owing the taxes. So that's where the investigation starts from. This investigation continued through 2007, earlier already. It moved from Kalmykia to Moscow on the federal level. And at some point, he was invited to have an interview with the police. They wanted to come over. They wanted to ask some questions. They wanted to see some documents. And Bill Browder instructed his people to ignore the police request. And the police said, fine, you don't have to cooperate. And as they didn't cooperate, then I think this was in June of 2007, his offices got raided. And at the same time, the offices of his legal representative, Firestone Duncan, were raided, where Sergei Magnitsky was the employee. This is how Bill Browder's legal problems in Russia got cooked up and escalated. And he had many options to minimize or straighten out his legal problems by paying the back taxes. This was simply the question of him paying his taxes correctly. And so this is issue A. Then there's issue B, because once Bill Browder was kicked out of Russia, there was a completely different level tax fraud that was organized. It is still not 100% certain who organized it and how, but we know some of the people who participated in it. But basically, here's what happened. A number of Russian-based entities that were owned by Bill Browder's Hermitage Capital Management got ostensibly stolen from him. Now, Bill Browder says that this was done during these June 2007 raids, which were part of his Kalmykia tax fraud investigation. He says that during those raids, the documents needed to steal his companies were confiscated, and that once the authorities confiscated these documents, they re-registered the companies in some common criminals' names. They created phony liabilities against these companies, in the exact amount of their 2006 profits, which turned out to be $1 billion, more or less, 900 and some million dollars, very close to a billion. And because these entities paid taxes on these profits, which were in the total amount of $230 million, as they created phony liabilities in the amount of this $1 billion, these new owners of the company turned around to the authorities and said, like, ah, as a matter of fact, you know, we paid taxes on these profits, but we have all these liabilities which wipe out the profits. So the profits go to zero. So could we please have those taxes reimbursed? So they filed to have $230 million worth of taxes reimbursed, and the Russian tax authorities paid this this money out. Okay, so the conflict about this particular tax fraud is that Russian tax authorities paid out $230 million in tax reimbursements, which were bogus, which were fraudulent. And Bill Browder built up a story accusing Russian police and Russian investigators of perpetrating this tax fraud. Now, he built a case that's credible on its face. As a narrative, it almost works. But a whole series of facts that need to corroborate this story don't add up. And so Bill Browder took his case to the Court of Public Relations. Basically, he wrote his book, The Red Notice, and he's going all over the world, all around, and he's giving his story in speeches, in interviews, in presentations, and so forth. And he's doing this as his full-time job, essentially, ever since. And he's using, well, yeah, and another detail I have to add is that as a part of all these tax fraud investigations, Sergei Magnitsky was detained for questioning, and he was basically thrown in prison. The condition for his release was that Bill Browder and Hermitage Capital pay the back taxes that they owed, which I think amounted to something equivalent to maybe $20 million. Bill Browder never paid. He refused to pay. And Sergei Magnitsky remained in prison for almost a year, except that he died before the investigation was completed.
Okay, so there's two questions there. First of all, $20 million is nothing compared to a billion in profit. And secondly, Magnitsky just died? I mean, what did he die of?
I think it was heart failure, but there were other problems with his pancreas, and I don't know exactly what is on his death certificate.
But I mean, surely, Bill Browder, I understand, is saying that he thinks he was murdered in prison.
Yeah, Bill Browder claims that Sergei Magnitsky was beaten to death in prison cell by prison guards in full riot gear. There has been several versions of this story, and Bill Browder ultimately backed away from this version of events because, you know, what happens is that the Russian filmmaker Sergei Nekrasov started making the film about Sergei Magnitsky and Bill Browder, a documentary. But when he initiated the film, he was going with Bill Browder's story. And he cooperated with Bill Browder on the scenario, on the scenography, and so forth. And one of the problems that cropped up is when they wanted to shoot the scene of Sergei Magnitsky getting killed by these riot police in his prison cell, where he was supposedly beaten for 1 hour, 18 minutes. The story went that eight police officers in full riot gear came in and beat him for 1 hour and 18 minutes. And when they wanted to shoot the scene, Sergei Nekrasov realized that they couldn't fit eight police officers in that prison cell, and they couldn't even fit seven police officers in the prison cell. So that was a problem. But you know, when he started reaching out to Bill Browder to say, like, well, you know, there are these problems, can you please explain to me what's going on, then Bill Browder suddenly made himself very scarce and wouldn't be answering his phones. And I think it took Andre about 2 or 3 months to track down Bill Browder and to confront him with all these questions and inconsistencies. And then it turns out that there are many, many, many inconsistencies in Bill Browder's narrative.
No, it's fascinating that we've got here something which has been going on right at the very beginning of the big new Cold War, an economic Cold War between the US particularly and Moscow. I mean, Hermitage Capital Management is an enormous company. Does it still exist
not? Sorry, Tony, I just want to correct you. It's not an enormous company. At its peak, it was a moderately sized hedge fund. Okay, so at its peak, I think they managed $4.3 billion. Now, that's a lot of money. But in the hedge fund industry, that's not a lot of money. That's a small fund. Okay, and maybe in 1997, that was big, but not enormous. You know, you have funds that manage tens, hundreds, thousands of billions of dollars, you know. So to put things in perspective, it was not that important of an entity. So, you know, Bill Browder built himself up as this, you know, very, very important factor in Russian economy between, you know, Western investors and so forth. Not so. It was one of the cogs in the big machine. Moderately sized, but not an enormous company.
As someone that's in this business yourself, can you just explain what a hedge fund is and what a hedge fund manager does?
Basically, hedge funds are unregulated investment vehicles, which means that a hedge fund can invest any which way it chooses. Ordinary mutual funds, pension funds, investment funds that serve retail investors have a very fairly rigidly regulated mode of operating, and they generally invest in very safe stocks and bonds, and they cannot go out of that mandate. Meaning, you know, you won't have a pension fund that invests in rare wines or artwork or I don't know. Exotic assets around the world. Hedge funds, by contrast, can invest investors' money any which way, any which place, whatever goes, which does not mean that I can take people's money and then do whatever I want with it. I have to strictly define what I will be doing with it, but that can be anything. That can be really stamps. It can be anything. So that's what a hedge fund is. In Bill Browder's case, the hedge fund was set up to invest in the Russian economy, which was in great turmoil in the 1990s as it was transitioning from the communist system to the free market capitalism. And so, yeah, basically that's what his overt activity was.
Okay, so where are we at now with the Magnitsky Act? It's been passed in the United States, and there is talk now about it coming through the European system, through the European Union. What is it? What does it prescribe?
Ostensibly, it sanctions human rights violations. It allows government bureaucrats, so executive branch, it allows government bureaucrats to impose sanctions on individuals and companies by freezing their assets, their overseas assets, by disallowing them to travel, so canceling their visas or not issuing their visas, and taking over their foreign assets. You know, so if they have apartments, bank accounts, and so forth. They can freeze them and even confiscate them, and they can deprive these people from traveling to Western nations that adopt this Magnitsky Act.
So what's the criteria of human rights then?
Well, that's not up to any due process of law. That's up to unnamed, faceless bureaucrats somewhere in the plumbing of the government, of the executive branch of government.
I mean, so could this act affect, say, somebody like you, Alex, in your work? Could you be sanctioned under this act?
Yeah, so could you. Yeah, absolutely. There's no reason why. They can just say, Alex is spreading hate speech or, intolerance or whichever, you know, it becomes a matter of narrative because there's no due process in this legislation. So people get sanctioned and put on this list, and their assets get frozen without any due process and without any recourse.
So what do you think is the real motive behind this?
Yeah, well, that's a very, very good question. And so the theory that I put forth in my book, and which since I published this book, much evidence came out which supports my guess on this, is that basically, so let's go back to the 1990s. What happened in 1990s is that Russian state assets were essentially raided by Western financiers and investors.
Yeah, they oligarchs, there, by the oligarchs. I mean, we're talking about actually.
Yeah, but you know, one thing to know about the oligarchs is that they were puppets on the string for Western financial interests. Okay, people like Jacob Rothschild, George Soros, and forth. So all these, how do you call them? Russian oligarchs were groomed and recruited out of the Komsomol, which was the youth communist, which is the youth organization of the Soviet Communist Party. And when the transition from a communist system to the capitalist system started to take shape, these young men were given credit in US dollars to buy up the Russian economy. Not because they were very clever and more capable than other Russians, but because they were puppets on the string for these very, very powerful Western interests. So what happened through the process is that between $200 and $600 billion worth of Russian assets were transferred to the Western ownership. And so we're talking real assets, you know, not, you know, nowadays, this word billion is thrown around like it's nothing. We're already throwing trillions around like it's nothing. We're talking real assets, not paper derivatives. So basically what happened is that between 200 billion and 600 billion worth of Russian assets were transferred into Western hands.
Now, you're talking about assets. I mean, are we talking about steel industries, aluminium industries, car industries, things like the National Airline, Aeroflot? Yeah. I mean, these are enormous, yeah, enormous concerns, yeah, aren't they?
Yes, these are enormous concerns. Something like close to 70% of all Russian economy ended up in the hands of these 11 handpicked oligarchs. And we found out about some of these agreements that existed because when Mikhail Khodorkovsky went to prison, it turned out that there was some kind of a contract existing between himself and Jacob Rothschild's interests, or himself, where if Mikhail Khodorkovsky became incapacitated and unable to manage the Yukos oil companies and Menatep Bank and I don't know what else there was, that the interests would be transferred to an unnamed third party. And then the Times of London, in one of their articles at the time, disclosed that this party was essentially Jacob Rothschild. This article disappeared, but a similar article effectively disclosing the same story is, I think, still online on one of the BBC sites. So basically, as it turns out, in a lot of these privatization schemes, going back to robber barons of the United States in the early 20s of last century, it always turns out that the oligarchs, like J.P. Morgan, like John Rockefeller, that they actually owned a relatively small percentage of the wealth that they ostensibly owned, and that the actual interests behind them are the international financial cartel families and individuals having control of the international financial cartel. And this was the case with the Russian oligarchs as well. So basically, to go back to the what was the point of the Magnitsky Act, when Putin came to power, he did not take the Western dictate anymore. And so there has been, I think, pretty much hundreds of investigations already from before Putin came to power, but they were killed. There have been hundreds of investigations of what happened to our assets. Where did they go? Who took them? How much did they pay for them? Who owns them now? And so forth. And so these investigations can do what they can do within the Russian system, but they cannot go beyond. So the Russian state investigators would then, the logical next step would be to file suits in a jurisdiction where these offshore companies are, in Cyprus, in Guernsey, in Jersey, in Cayman Islands, in London, in New York, and so forth. And, you know, when you file a lawsuit, when you start an investigation of this sort, then, you know, in Western jurisdiction, a lot of things start happening it's a mechanism. You hire lawyers, they start finding out documents, they start filing Freedom of Information Act, they start deposing the actors, the witnesses, and so forth, and a lot of what has happened comes out on record, black on white, that can be just made to disappear. You know, becomes part of the public record forever. So my theory was that the whole purpose of the Magnitsky Act was to frustrate Russian investigations into who took their assets, because that's also their means of recovering their assets eventually, to establish that this was not a purchase in good faith, that this was not a fair economic value that was paid for them, and that therefore the whole process was under duress or whatever, and that to start to reverse them. So in order to make this impossible, in order to frustrate the Russians at every step, I think it is necessary for these financial interests that participated in the 1990s raid on Russia to create legal barriers for the Russian state to go after these assets. And this is what Magnitsky Act is exactly. It exactly acts as this barrier, because whoever would come from Russia to pursue the investigations can be simply put on this list, and first of all, legally frustrated, and second of all, morally tainted, because they would say like, look, he's a sanctioned individual, he's some kind of a human rights abuser, he's some kind of a terrible, corrupt politician or policeman or, you know, bureaucrat coming from Russia. We don't want to cooperate with people like that. You know, it would put pressure on lawyers to not cooperate with the Russian authorities and so forth. So I think this is the objective of the Magnitsky Act.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Emma Burgess from We Love Stoke Lodge, and also Alex Craner, author of Grand Deception, The Truth About Bill Browder and the Magnitsky Act. Also thanks to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects are Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you've got some precious spare time, you can volunteer with us, or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Get a little money. When he told me the requirements, I started feeling funny.
They said, you ain't got a house, you ain't got a plot, I ain't got a window and I ain't got a job. But it takes a lot of blue back to satisfy my heart. If I could get my hands on some F.O. tomorrow. Well, I went to the social just to get a little pension. I was sorely in distress, I was needing some attention. He said, you don't get a qualified, don't get a damn. That's why I broke his jaw, that's why I'm doing time. But it takes a lot of blue backs to satisfy my heart. If I could get my hands on some F.O. tomorrow. My lawyer in the city, he said, you're gonna come and see me, boy, it really is a pity. Those savings you got in the casino disappeared. And he went out the window real quick, honey. And I'll do it all again, but it may sound funny if I could get my hands on some F.O. tomorrow. Get my hands on some F.O. tomorrow. Well, I went to my banker just to raise a little money. He said, I'm glad to see it, but I started feeling funny. He said, you ain't got a house, you ain't got a job, I got a window and I ain't got a plot. It takes a lot of blue backs to satisfy my heart. I could get my hands on some F.O. tomorrow. F.O. tomorrow. F.O. tomorrow. F.O. tomorrow.